Freedom News Hour with Jake Towns, Walt Thiessen, and Gene DiNardo, Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds peaceful. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines,
they're standing in the unemployment line, and unfortunately it's going to keep growing. But this is the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown here on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, along with Jake Towns. We're hoping that Gene DiNardo is going to be joining us shortly here on this Thursday, June 9th, 2011. And news has been a little bit quiet this week, just like last week. It's kind of like everything's gearing up for the summer, but this could very well be, Jake, the summer of explosiveness where the monetary system is concerned. We're getting lots of signals, particularly from the precious metal folks, suggesting that this is going to be a very volatile summer, which is going to really kind of surprise a lot of people, because traditionally summertime is a very quiet time, not just for precious metal trading, but for stock trading and so on and so forth. I don't know, do you see it differently, or do you see relatively the same thing happening?
Oh yeah, the slogan "sell in May and go away." A lot of stock traders do really take the summer off, and particularly in Europe, where you have all the uproar with Greece and the other countries that are under heavy financial pressure, their governments. A lot of those countries end up going on vacation. Like pretty much all of Europe goes on vacation, like the end of July and all of August, really. And anybody that's done business with Europe realizes that there's just nobody around. Everybody's on vacation. And
or if you've gone to some vacation spot in summer where the Europeans go.
Right. And all too often what usually happens in the marketplace is what you don't expect to happen. And like what we highlighted on last week's show, with the quantitative easing policy due to end at the end of this month, with no final definitive answer what's going to happen in July until really the June 22nd FOMC meeting, which is taking place, I guess that'll be next Wednesday, two Wednesdays from now. So we'll be covering that on our show that following Thursday. Without that, and with a lot of the debt being rescheduled by Greece, it's hard to say. I agree with you, Walt. I think that there's a big potential for the summer to have a lot of, unfortunately, financial pain, and to say nothing of the fall. So it kind of feels a little bit like the whole world, whether it's the oil price or the gold price or the Dow Jones or the British FTSE or the Nikkei index. It kind of feels like everything is trading on eggshells.
It kind of reminds me a little bit of this time during the summer of 2008. Of course, we know what all that led up to. A couple of things that have been happening, though, that are really beginning to catch attention, although the major media haven't really latched onto it yet, are the troubles going on over in Europe. And interesting articles that have come out, particularly one that I saw on Bloomberg, I believe it was, this past week, contrasting the views of Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and ECB President Jean-Claude Trichet. Bernanke saying that any inflation that's going to come, he thinks is going to be transitory. That's pretty much the same message he's been giving all along. But Trichet saying that he feels they're going to have a strong vigilance warranted on inflation. So basically the two major central bank leaders taking contrasting positions. Very interesting.
And the European Bank, haven't they already ratcheted up their interest rates a bit?
And actually, this is assumed by many to be a prelude to the next round of ratcheting, although I'd say ratcheting is probably not the right word just yet, because we're talking about very, very minuscule changes for the moment. But typically, whenever central banks want to take a move like this, they kind of give you a foreshadowing of it, and it sounds like that's what Trichet has been doing. Meanwhile, of course, problems continue with the euro and the European countries that are particularly involved with financial crises, Greece in particular having lots of troubles. Jake, I know you have a few details about that. What do you got?
Right. With the news that just came out today on Greece is that the European governments and the International Monetary Fund, which is funded in part by the U.S. taxpayer, will lend as much as an extra 45 billion euros or $65 billion to Greece under an expanded plan to avoid the euro area's first sovereign default. Two people with direct knowledge of the talk said this was put out on Bloomberg today. And European estimates put Greece's 2012-2014 fiscal financing gap is as much as 170 billion euros. It would be filled by the loans, plus around 157 billion euros in unspent aid from last year's bailout, roughly 30 billion euros in asset sale proceeds, and about 30 billion euros in rollover by creditors. So, like you had mentioned, Trichet's, I think they have moved up the interest rate by maybe 0.25%, and there's talk that it may go up by another 0.25% in the following month or two to follow. But I think that you have to realize what's kind of going on there, and between the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. and Europe is a little bit different. In Europe, everybody's concerned. And it's kind of funny because if you read through the EU Constitution, which has already been shredded to pieces, or the treaty, I should say, not the Constitution, it specifically states that countries, there's no bailouts by one country allowed of another country. And, of course, the rest of the EU, led by Germany, has bailed out Greece quite a bit. Merkel, Chancellor Merkel, has been sound. Her party has been soundly defeated in multiple elections over the past year or so, related primarily to the idea that Germany is now kind of like the whipping boy and is bailing out these other countries that have just grown their entitlements and everything so much that it is kind of like an unstoppable. It's like an unstoppable chain reaction where the people that are in Greece right now are so dependent on the government jobs, their pensions, and the government providing everything for them that they, you know, go on strike and do all these other things. And they really, because they control the politicians in Greece, like the last election that Greece had was really a competition among leaders to who was going to spend the most on the Greek people. And that's the funniest thing that we talked about on prior shows, is that the euro is kind of used as a method to transfer wealth from the more prosperous and productive countries in the European Union to the lesser productive countries such as Greece and Spain. And what we're seeing is that those countries have kind of been addicted to this flow of extra credit. And it's the European Central Bank, which was lauded for many years as supposedly being independent of these governments in the EU. It has now been proven that they are pretty much just in cahoots with them. I mean, there used to be a provision against the European Central Bank against buying the actual debt of these countries. That's been thrown all to the windows. And one can argue, you know, exactly what, if they're doing is correct or not. But at the end of the day, you know, things are kind of just continuing to unfold there, because whatever cuts Greece has made, and they have made some cuts along the way, it's just not enough. I think when we talked about last week, like the interest rate on a two-year note in Greece is 26%, and the interest rate on a 10-year was over 16%, and that might have changed from last week to this week, but it's
probably higher.
Really, yeah, probably higher. And when you take a look at everything that's kind of gone on, and you look into the past, like, it wasn't all that. Again, Goldman Sachs was used to kind of cook the Greek accounting books for a few years in order to get them into the European Union. Past the supposedly stringent entrance requirements. But what has really happened since then, and they, for many years, Greece, you know, through the early 2000s, they had all the benefits of being in the EU, and their debt had a comparable interest rate to that of Greece and France, Germany, had a comparable interest rate to that of Germany for many years. And that just because everybody figured, oh, it's all in euros, so it's all kind of the same. And it's really just about now that people figure out that, hey, you know, there's a problem with this paper currency. And what the European Central Bank is doing is, you know, this 45 billion euros that, or 65 billion more dollars that I just referred to that they're going to, Greece is going to need to continue its welfare state. You know, that money is very obviously just coming from, is just being printed out of thin air. I mean, in Greece's somewhat defense, it's kind of funny how things have worked because, like, for instance, the sales tax in Greece, like, if you want to buy, like, there's obviously a very large black market, but when I tell you what the sales tax rate is, I believe it's 23%, and that's at least what it was back in 2010. That's a phenomenal interest rate on yeah, sales taxes. You know. Like I think, you know, here in Pennsylvania, where I'm from, the sales tax is 6%, and that's already pretty darn pretty high.
And in France, isn't it like 42% or something like that?
Yeah, well, they also have the VAT and everything. Yeah, I'm not quite sure if the sales tax. My source for this is an excellent book that was written last year by Philip Bagus that you can get for free on a site called Mises.org. Just type in Tragedy of the Euro PDF, Mises, M-I-S-E-S, and come up. It's a fantastic reading. It goes through the whole history of the European Union, and the last few chapters focus on bringing everybody up, fairly up to date on the whole Greek tragedy.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was an interesting article I saw this past Monday, and the fact that it came out then is kind of interesting in light of this latest action by the European Central Bank to try to help keep Greece afloat. It's an article that appeared actually in the Associated Press. It was distributed around the world, and it comes from Frankfurt, Germany, where a top European Central Banker named Lorenzo Bini Smaghi, I hope I'm not pronouncing that wrong, made a very curious statement. He said that Greece could essentially take care of their debt problem, that the way to do it is that Greece is solvent to the extent that it is willing to sell off some of its assets. And the assets it's talking about are things like the Parthenon.
Wow.
So basically, he suggested that if Greece wanted to get out of their financial trouble, they could do it by selling off their national treasures.
There you go, yeah. That applies to a lot of countries, I'm sure.
Well, it does, but I don't honestly really believe that the European Central Bank was serious about that.
Oh, well, I don't know.
But nevertheless, the fact that they even put that out there is really quite astonishing. I mean, that's almost libertarian in its approach.
Yeah, right.
So that was, I'm not sure what to even make of that. I think maybe it might have been like a softening up of the Germans and the people who are basically, as Jake pointed out, bailing out the Greeks,
a way
to kind of make them feel like, you know, we're really on your side. Now we're going to lend the money.
The thing's in pretty bad shape. They might not get too good of a price for it. It's kind of a fixer, you know.
Well, all they have to do is put it through Sotheby's and they'll be all right.
Yeah. Little mortar.
Oh, dear. Well, of course, it's not just overseas where problems are occurring. They're occurring here, too, and foreclosures continue to be a problem. And, Gina, I understand they're actually they're ramping up in your neck of the woods out there in Oregon. What's the story? What's the scoop?
Well, we're always a little behind the curve. and there is an explanation for this other than just it's bad times in Oregon. The foreclosure filings were up 236%. And actually, it says nationally newly launched foreclosure actions dropped 14% in April, according to Realty Track Incorporated. But in Oregon, where they've jumped 236% from 1,100 to 3,700. I think they're going by the month there. The surge in notices of default come from one loan servicer, Bank of America Corp's foreclosure arm, Recon Trust Company. It follows a jump in canceled foreclosures filed by Recon Trust in late February and March, and that was due to the problems they're having. Oregon is an out-of-court foreclosure state where you don't have to go to court, and they're just running into all kinds of problems because basically they don't have their record straight. Bank of America spokesperson Jumana Bowen said the withdrawals and the new filings resulted from a review late last year of the company's foreclosure process when it halted sales in all 50 states. On the other hand, Phil Curran, a real estate attorney and critic of the finance industry's handling of the foreclosure, said Recon Trust's new foreclosure starts are no different. They're doing the same thing they were before. They've not recorded successful assignments. He claims No matter what they said, they're just going back to the bank with the same faulty paperwork, or back to the courts and trying to file and see what happens. So anyway, this is one company, arm of Bank of America, that has just got back into the action. On the other, we talked about something last week.
So let me clarify this. One company, one bank, getting back into the foreclosure action almost tripled the number of foreclosures in Oregon.
Exactly, because they had held out. They had held out. You know, they had pulled all their foreclosures back.
Well, that raises a question. How many others are being withheld because of all the foreclosure mess and the MERS mess?
Well, I think that's a. I think from what I've read, Bank of America is the biggest actor in Oregon. But I think that's a good question. It's a good point. I think the other major players just haven't gone back and you know, attempted to submit all these foreclosures again. They're trying to they're trying to you know, get it together to where they figure out what they can do. And another thing we talked about last week was in Oregon, another Oregon deal was that actual mortgage industry was pushing the legislation to or legislators to pass a kind of give them a free pass, you could say, and that was denied. And I'll read a little bit from that article. A late attempt by the finance industry to waive Oregon's mortgage recording laws, they were basically going to get rid of the laws, in most foreclosures, is dead. The Oregon House Judiciary Committee voted Wednesday to approve Senate Bill 519. And what's interesting about this, Senate Bill 519 was a low-income housing bill. And the amendment they're going to attach by the loan servicers, title company, and credit unions was to allow them to bring faulty paperwork into court. The amendment would have, I'm reading again here, the amendment would have relieved lenders of ensuring a property's ownership history is properly recorded in public records before foreclosing outside a courtroom. Afterward, co-chairman of the committee, Jeff Barker, cited a public outcry over the amendment as a reason for its failure, and described the intense backroom negotiations to do so. There was a lot of opposition. I probably got more emails about this than anything all session. So it goes on to say there are literally thousands of foreclosures in Oregon that are presently on hold as servicers contemplate the meaning and impact of some of the decisions that have been handed down of late.
If you think about the fact, I mean, you mentioned that it was basically a subsidiary, I guess, of Bank of America that affected Oregon's foreclosure rate so dramatically. Bank of America is not just the biggest bank in Oregon. They're the biggest bank in the country.
Right, exactly.
You know, and we do know they were and always have been right at the center of the foreclosure mess. What if they are withholding so many mortgage foreclosures and it just hasn't really filtered down to the press? I mean, you read the press and the typical take is that we've reached the peak. But now I'm beginning to wonder. Because
well,
I mean, if they can increase it by that amount just with one company in Oregon, why can't they do that in other states around the country?
I think it varies state by state. You know, some of the states have been very lenient and said, you know, bring us anything you got. You know, we'll go by what you say. Because basically, if you're out of court, you're not. You know, there's nothing to judge your paperwork.
Yeah, exactly.
And what they do is they sue. You know, they say the person that's being foreclosed upon will say, you know, your paperwork's terrible, and they'll have to bring actually a complaint back against the bank or whoever's running the foreclosure through, and that's the only way it's getting noticed. But yeah, it's being buried, and I think that you're just seeing local news, and I haven't seen anything on the national front, but I think the fact that it is in the 50 states is a big plus, you know, for justice, you know, not to have, you know, people should pay their mortgages, but this is just corruption, I think, at the core. It's terrible. And
I think it's going to be something to watch, because if it turns out that Bank of America is withholding more mortgage foreclosures than the major media realize, and if that hits at about the same time everything else hits, it's just one more domino lined up.
Yeah,
it might be a
situation.
Pretty major domino. I mean, the fact that, you know, if the media ever does report or someone finally blows the whistle, similar to Meredith Whitney did back in 2007,
right.
People realize that, you know, the emperor has no clothes and the balance sheets of the banks, that they are far too overextended. They're far too, and what they do claim is worth just, you know, small fractions of what they're actually claiming. When that comes out, then we'll see some of these banks go under, despite all the efforts of U.S. Congress to bail out these bankers and keep these things going.
It wasn't Bank of America was very close to doing that just months ago, weren't they? Wasn't it six, seven months ago? The question of whether they were solvent or not was up in the air, I think.
Well, technically, they're all insolvent.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I think Bank of America in particular has been very, very weak all along, and in part because they've taken on the assets of banks that have already gone through failure, although that you would think that would actually enrich them, because when that happens, it's the FDIC and the federal government that take on all the losses, and that means we take on the losses, and the remaining good assets are passed along. So in theory, that should have made Bank of America better, but in practice, I don't think you can really say that, because even the ones that are supposedly good assets, the good mortgages, a lot of those have started to bail over the last year, year and a half or so. So not a good situation where the banking community is concerned.
Wasn't it Bank of America that made the genius move, when kind of might have been also told by the government and Hank Paulson to buy Countrywide Financial?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, that was a great
buy. I think they did.
What
I kind of lose track of everything that happened to Merrill Lynch and all those other countries, but companies. But I'm
countries, yeah, they are.
Yeah, when you acquire Countrywide, which was run by Angelo Mugila, who pretty much kind of knew what he was doing with the whole subprime.
Oh, he knew what he was doing, all right. Tune him at $500 billion in profits for himself.
Yep, that's right.
Oh my goodness.
Well, they looked at it. They did claim they looked at it, though. I mean, they said they sent their best people. They looked at it. And right before they bought it and right after, they said, it's in great shape, and we're glad we bought it. We got it at a great price. So, I guess they look, but they don't see.
Well, the one thing that you can count on with all this is that as all of these great financial difficulties just keep piling on, the politicians with a couple of notable exceptions that we both know about, that we all three of us know about, most of them are just going to continue their merry way, pretending that nothing is going on, and some of them are actually going to trip over their own shoes along the way. Jake, I know you've got some details about that one. What's the latest about Newt Gingrich?
Well, this just came out on the Christian Science Monitor, of all places, that the top Newt Gingrich aides in his campaign have quit.
All of them.
His top campaign aides, which include his campaign manager and his spokesman, were among the crew that have decided to quit his campaign. So the media, obviously, is already questioning Gingrich's campaign. I say, sometimes we complain about on the show about not reporting happy news. This is probably pretty good. So hopefully that'll leave the way for more, I would say, freedom and liberty-oriented candidates like Gary Johnson and Ron Paul to kind of make more headway as the Republican. I think there's another debate on June 13th on CNN, which will be next week. So.
But can you imagine that? I mean, your entire top staff all walk out on the same day? And from what I was reading, it sounds like they did it because they were convinced that Gingrich wasn't really committed to his own campaign.
I'm just flabbergasted. I guess it's not exactly known at this point, but be interesting to see if they got signing bonuses or not.
Yeah, right.
Well, it may not make any difference because apparently one of Gingrich's biggest faults, according to the aides who quit en masse, is that he wasn't doing any fundraising. So if he wasn't doing any fundraising, there may not be any money to pay those big bonuses.
I guess it's not true.
Unbelievable. How can a guy who was the Speaker of the House do such a botched-up job launching a campaign right after he announced he's running? It's mind-boggling. I mean, say what you like about Gingrich, and I'm sure all three of us could say plenty, but just as a politician, I always thought he was smarter than this, and I guess maybe he's not.
Yeah, I don't know. I know he. I used to like him just because some of the stuff he said was so off the wall. It was funny.
He was definitely entertaining.
He was always entertaining, yeah.
He often pissed a lot of people off, too, but that's another story.
Yeah, he did.
I guess I should add, in this article, Gingrich has vowed he will stay in the race.
Yes, he actually posted something on his Facebook account. Interesting.
I think we should add that.
So
we're not rid of him yet.
He hasn't disappeared, but let's just say he's on the way down.
Well, how many times has he run now?
Oh,
for
God.
President, I'm not sure.
Five different, let's see, both of the Bush, Clinton, at least four, anyway.
His name usually surfaces around this time.
Yeah.
Right. And actually, Jake, you mentioned that this is a little piece of good news. There's actually another good piece of news that came out this week, and it kind of missed everybody's notice, but there was a candidate to be one of the next governors on the Federal Reserve Board, and he's an MIT professor. His name is Peter Diamond, and his nomination had been before Congress for quite some time. Interestingly enough, a number of Republican senators had been really working very strongly against him, led by Richard Shelby of Alabama. The basis for their public opposition was kind of silly because they were questioning his expertise, saying that his experience was all with labor finance rather than monetary policy. But,
that's terrible, isn't it?
what's even more ridiculous is that this was a Nobel Prize winner. He just won the Nobel Prize last December.
They don't want to get a Nobel Peace Prize for running a few wars and stirring up another one in Libya. So.
But still, that's usually enough to get, regardless of what we may say about the Nobel Prize, just having it is usually enough to get you a lot of attention, a lot of respect, and so forth. And that's decidedly the thing that the Republicans decided to go against. It turns out that this economist is very much in lockstep with Ben Bernanke on QE3 and what should be done along those lines. He totally agrees with what they've been doing. So that's the good piece of news. Somebody who believes in this massive monetary expansion is not going to get onto the board in the next available seat. But how we got there is just bizarre because it doesn't look like the Republicans were actually opposing him based on that. They were opposing him based on his lack of qualifications on monetary policy because his work was all about labor monetary. I don't quite understand that.
Well, you mentioned that his nomination has been formally withdrawn, right?
Yeah, he actually withdrew it himself. In fact, he filed an opinion article, an op-ed, with the New York Times, and that's where he announced that he had withdrawn his nomination.
Okay.
Yeah. But weird stuff going on. I guess if that's what it takes to keep a monetarist off the Fed, well, fine, but I'd really rather they keep him off based on the fact that he's a monetarist. call me crazy,
That's the guys they want.
Well, that is exactly the guys they want, unfortunately. And we're often stuck with the results that come out of that. Meanwhile, of course, despite the fact that all these wonderful things are happening, we've got the usual boondoggles coming out of Washington, D.C., and all the special tax breaks and the subsidies and so forth. In fact, Gene, you've got a little quick story to tell us about subsidies to airlines that fly to Asia. What's that about?
This is another local story, and this is good because, we always think of free trade and free this and free that, but actually it's not very free. And Asiana Airlines will get more than $750,000 from Oregon taxpayers and the Port of Portland. Now, that right there, the Port of Portland, people misunderstand what ports are, and ports are kind of quasi, well, they're obviously monopolies, airports and harbors, et cetera, but they're often much like utilities in that they're private companies, often run them and receive money from the taxpayer to keep their profits up. They're going to receive this subsidy to fly cargo jets between PDX and Seoul, South Korea, a nonstop service that they claim will help Northwest exporters and challenge Anchorage as a trans-Pacific pit stop. Port officials who operate Portland International Airport disclose the incentives split between cash and landing fee waivers after a news conference Wednesday announcing the cargo service. The flights by Boeing 747 freighters will begin September 2nd and operate three times a week. Asiana will get $200,000 from Governor John Kitzhaber's Strategic Reserve Fund to cover ground handling operations and another $200,000 from the fund to offset costs if the Seoul-based airline runs the flights for a year. The director of the Portland Port said that Port will also waive landing fees for a year, a benefit worth between $350,000 and $400,000, and will provide advertising support for several years. So they're even going to advertise for them. They were competing against different cities, and this is how the ante gets upped until it gets high enough to where they're willing to do it. On outbound journeys, Asiana's 747s will stop for refueling in Anchorage on their way from Seoul to Miami, carrying Asian exports to the United States. On return flights, they'll stop in Portland instead of Anchorage, picking up U.S. exports. Each time a freighter lands in Portland during the first year, Asiana will save between $4,000 and $6,000, usually charged in weight-based landing fees. The port, which gets a small percentage of its revenue from taxes and the lion's share from business earnings, will eat those costs. So this just points out that our free trade and is really not so free if you're the taxpayer.
It's quite expensive if you're the taxpayer, no doubt about that.
And, you know, we all will say, where have all our jobs gone and where have our manufacturing gone? And, you know, we don't look at what governments are doing to promote other countries, you know, trading and producing overseas. And, you know, aside from the obvious breaks that the corporation gets on tax breaks.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break here, and then after the break, we're going to talk about an interesting gaffe made by a Chinese official who actually admitted that the U.S. is trying to undermine its own currency, plus the Republican Party trying to redistrict Ron Paul out of office. So stay tuned. This is the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
Come to the Progressive Radio Network each day for the best progressive minds in the world.
Did you miss your favorite show on Progressive Radio Network? Well, no need to worry. We have all of our shows archived on our website. Go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and find the show you're looking for.
I'm so excited to be on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'll be able to talk to you live, answer your questions, and work with you for your own patient rights. Tune in every Sunday at 5 p.m. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. See you on Sunday, 5 p.m.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
To the Progressive Radio Network each day for the best progressive minds in the world.
Yeah, run right back to that radio dial because we're back here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. And I want to remind you that you can always check out our website at www.freedomnewshour.com to find out the latest and greatest. Lately, of course, we haven't had a lot of guests on, but when we do have a guest on, that's where we will post it first. So be sure to check that out each week. Find out who's coming. And you'll also find some very good videos there to watch and some references to earlier stories. And you can also find the archives. Full archives of the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown dating back to when we started the show in January 2010. So check it all out there at www.freedomnewshour.com. And before the break, we talked about, or I mentioned actually, a little bit of a gaffe that took place over in China. I don't know if Jake or Gene, you heard about this, but I'm not going to pronounce the name properly, I'm sure, but Guan Tao, who is, or Dao I guess it is, of the State Administration of Foreign Exchange, made comments that appeared briefly, very briefly, on a website in China that said that China should guard against risks from, quote, excessive, unquote, holdings of U.S. assets as Washington could pursue a policy to weaken the dollar. And then shortly after he made that comment, it was quickly removed. at his own request, because China all along has been trying to publicly support the dollar. And Jake, why is it they're trying to support the dollar?
Because they own a lot of our debt.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think the key slogan is, if I owe you a dollar, I have a problem, but if I owe you $1 trillion, then you're the one that has the problem, because you need to pay you.
But you don't say that publicly. Interesting little mistake there. That's not the kind of mistake the Chinese usually make either. It almost makes me wonder if it was deliberate, like they were trying to send a signal to somebody. Hard to tell. But we'll have to keep an eye on that to see if we get any more gas coming from China. And meanwhile, of course, as I mentioned before the break, the Republican Party, they're doing the redistricting this year based on the 2010 census, and it turns out they are going after the district of Congressman Ron Paul of Texas, who is a favorite of ours here on the Freedom News Hour. In fact, there are a couple of Democratic operatives and analysts who have said specifically this is an attempt to get Ron Paul out of the Republican Party. And Jake and Gene, of course, he's been in the Republican Party for quite some time, even though he was a Libertarian candidate for president in 1988. But since then, he's been very solidly doing everything within the Republican Party. What do you think this foreshadows? Because essentially they're trying to cut his district in half and take away a large portion of the constituency that supports him every year or every 2 years.
So they actually want to give up the seat to get rid of him?
Well, it doesn't look like they're trying to get rid of the seat. They're trying to get rid of Ron Paul and basically do so by undercutting his current constituency, handing it off to two other Republicans who are around him, or at least one Republican who's next to him, and then put more minorities into his district so that it's harder for him to win, and therefore perhaps justify putting in a more conservative candidate into his seat.
Right. I'm not even sure if Texas has a single Democrat congressman. I may be proven wrong there, but it's a very strongly Republican state.
It is. It's very strongly Republican. Yeah. The one weakness, I guess you could say, geographically for Dr. Paul is that he's very close, his district is very close to the Mexican border. So they do, right near the edge of his district, there is a significant Hispanic and minority population. And by adding a large portion of that population to his newly redistricted district, they're basically making it harder for him to be reelected. Of course, they're also making it a little bit easier for a Democrat to be reelected, or to be elected, I should say. So we'll have to see whether or not that's a wise position to take or not. But clearly, they're trying to take away Paul's constituency. And
right, that's fascinating, because the fellow's running for president, and pretty much whatever poll you take a look at, he's pulling at over 10%, which in a field of probably like eight or so people is not too shabby.
Yeah, he's running a consistent third poll after poll. I mean, he does vary from poll to poll. But
and Romney's running first?
Yes, typically Romney first, Palin second, and Paul third.
What percentage is he pulling?
I've seen anywhere from 16 to 24% for Romney. But I don't expect that to hold, because he pretty much collapsed last time around, and I don't see anything that's changed for Romney. I think he continues to collapse. I mean, he's basically appealing to what we might call the moderate Republican base, as opposed to the conservative base.
Right. Out on the whatever our particular feelings are on certain things, some of the things about Romney, such as the Romney Care initiative in Massachusetts, and also he recently stated that as president he would be in favor of doing things along the lines of global warming. Those are two things that, regardless of where you stand on the issues, typically Republicans don't like to hear that.
Yeah, they don't like to hear that. Right?
His opponents are having a good time bringing that up. And there was also that whole debacle where he kind of thought, or the media was reporting, that Sarah Palin was trying to steal his sunshine on his announcement day and that sort of thing. So.
And that's more of just the political jostling. It doesn't have anything really to do with issues.
Right, right. Well, as far as I know, Ms. Palin still hasn't announced that she's running, so who knows what's going on there.
she's having a lot of fun driving her bus around the country, though.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe she's hoping that more people like Gingrich will self-destruct and their campaign teams will give up.
that could be the Palin strategy. It's quite possible, because the people who are the front runners, with the exception of Dr. Paul, they're very, very much set up to topple themselves.
I saw a poll where it said that 75% of Republicans, they just did a random poll, didn't want Palin to be the nominee.
Yeah. Well, Palin doesn't really have a ghost of a chance. And I don't like Palin, so I should perhaps put that out there as
another bit of good news.
Well, not so much. Well, I suppose from my point of view, it's a bit of good news. But I should also put out there the fact that I do have that bias. But nevertheless, I think from an objective point of view, she really doesn't have a chance to get elected, because one of the most important things from a pure political analysis point of view is that if you look at the candidates' level of support, they're what they call the favorables versus the unfavorables. The favorables are, where are they getting their support? The unfavorables are those people who wouldn't vote for the candidate if you hand them $1,000. And if your unfavorables reach the 50% point or higher, it becomes virtually impossible for you to be elected. If your favorables are, say, at the 40 to 45% range, and your unfavorables are in the 30s, well, that leaves you somewhere between like 15 to 25 percentage points that you could potentially move up. So you have some room to move with. But if your unfavorables are already in the 50s, you can't reach a 50% majority. And people who tend to take that position about a candidate very rarely change their minds.
Yeah.
Well, Palin's unfavorables are in the high 50s.
Because people either like her or they don't.
And the vast majority, not the vast, but close to what we might call a landslide majority, are against her.
Yeah.
Definitely do not want her to be a candidate and would not vote for her. That's almost insurmountable. So she has perhaps a very good chance of winning the Republican nomination, but her unfavorables will absolutely kill her in a general election against President Obama or any other Democrat. It makes no difference who she opposed.
So you're saying she won't be president?
She can't be unless there's a tremendous change in the electorate's opinion in a way that has never happened before.
Yeah, right. Very unusual.
It would take that kind of a cataclysmic change for her to get elected, and I just don't see that happening. I don't care how popular she is among the Tea Party folks.
Yeah, and her past history of resigning from office in order to, in effect, monetize her popularity from the last presidential campaign.
Yeah, that doesn't help too much.
probably not help too much. But, it's perfectly possible she's just, taking advantage of things to further monetize herself.
Yeah, I think that's what she's interested in. I mean, I would think she would take the presidency, but I think she's basically just is trying to earn a living, a good living, and that's how she sees the best way to do it.
I'm not quite sure what she's doing. I mean,
no, I agree with that too.
I mean, she had a reality TV show and she absolutely blew it.
Huh.
Well,
that's
the kind of thing that I would not expect somebody who's trying to reap huge rewards for themselves would do. And yet, she basically undermined her own show with her own commentary.
Huh.
So, I mean, I don't quite get. I don't grok Sarah Palin. You guys know the word grok?
Grok, no.
No.
That, like, I don't get her. I don't know. I actually kind of get her, but I don't get people actually liking her. Well, I don't want to use the word like, but, actually believing that she's an actual possible candidate. I mean, to me, that's absurd.
Well, the main thing among her supporters that she's kind of liked for is, she's a little bit of I don't want to say George Bushian, but maybe I kind of mean that. She has a ability to, seem like she's out there having fun and to somewhat relate. And she's coming from Alaska. She was seen in the McCain thing as a bit of a Washington outsider.
Right.
But, things have changed since then. So
things have changed. And the thing that I think has given her some of her support, believe it or not, is the Libertarian side of the country, so to speak.
Now that I don't get at all.
and yet it does seem to be true. A lot of libertarians have fallen for her rhetoric, which is not terribly surprising when you think about it, because libertarians as a movement, by libertarian, I don't mean people who necessarily self-identify. Most libertarians don't self-identify as libertarians. I mean people who adopt a libertarian viewpoint on issues, regardless of whether they call themselves by that name. And there's a large percentage of that group that all you have to do is have a candidate that says things that sounds like they're in favor of liberty and freedom, and they just are attracted to it like a magnet.
They fall for it.
Yeah, they fall for it. And she's very good at that. I don't want to draw the comparison between her and Reagan because it's been drawn so many times, and there's so much controversy about whether she's truly a intellectual descendant of Reagan and all that kind of thing. I don't even care about that particular argument. But the one thing that she and Reagan very much had in common is that they were both able to con the public, particularly the libertarian section part of the public.
Yeah, I think that's true. I actually think she's a neocon, her political views.
I think she is too, actually. She has done an excellent job of masking her own views, particularly where foreign policy and foreign intervention are concerned.
At the very beginning, if you go back to the Katie Couric interviews, it was more covering up ineptness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's that too. But I do have to give her credit because she has successfully danced around the issue every time anybody has ever brought it up. So it enables her to sound like she's small government when in fact she's not. There have been very few times where she's actually said something that told you, well, wait a minute, she's really an interventionist. But unless you know to look for those little tiny details, you can, if you believe in small government, you could actually be sucked in by what she says.
I agree, right.
It's sad but true. What's going to be interesting to see is whether or not that actually continues to hold true as the primary season approaches, because if she does become a candidate, and I think there's a very decent chance she will declare to be a candidate for the Republican nomination, if that happens, I suspect, first of all, we're going to see a lot more of what we saw the first time around when she was the VP candidate. There's going to be a lot more of the, I'm not sure what to call it, but let's just put it this way. The liberal side are going to do everything they can to destroy her candidacy. I think we're going to see a lot of that. And when that happens, it's going to be fascinating to watch what happens among her libertarian-esque supporters, because eventually I think the wool's going to be pulled from their eyes. How are they going to react to that? I'm not sure. Jake, what do you think?
Well, you know, I think for sure she would definitely draw a lot of flack.
She definitely
and,
will.
In some ways, that's kind of what, unfortunately, sometimes that's what the parties kind of look for. I mean, notwithstanding what you mentioned about the whole favorables versus unfavorables, but Sarah Palin does kind of have going for her for the Republican side, you know, kind of a little bit what Mr. Obama brought, which was something different. Like she
right.
would be, if elected, the first female president of the United States, which is something, aside from her, is something I think would be a really great event.
Sure.
Just, you know, not somebody like her.
Just not her, yeah.
But, you know, the whole thing is that it is very unclear what she's trying to do. It does appear that she's at least trying to leave a lot of her options open, whether she's going to run or whether she's just going to play kingmaker, in effect, or try to play that, or just continue trying to make money with her talks and that sort of thing. It's very unclear. And it would also, I think, what might be kind of going on, because at the level of status that she has, she is pretty much a speaker for the Republican National Committee. I don't think there's really any doubt of that. And it would be interesting to know kind of what the Republican National Committee is thinking of her. I don't think that's something that's known to the public, but if we did know that, it would kind of shed the light on some of this stuff.
That would be an interesting thing to know, wouldn't it? How much support does she have, say, among the executive board of the RP? It's hard to say for sure, but boy, it certainly seems like they line up behind her, or at least at times it does. By the way, guys, I don't know if you heard about this. This is kind of I'm going to shift gears here. We're going to talk about precious metals for a bit now. But did you know that California is set to try to outlaw gold prospecting?
California, of all states?
That's right.
The gold rush?
Yes. 162 years after history's biggest gold rush, diggers, or dredgers as they are now called, are losing a long-running battle with environmentalists. And the reason for this mammoth fight is salmon. It turns out at the center of the battle is suction dredging, which is today's mechanized version of gold panning. And apparently there are some 4,000 people in California currently trying to extract gold using this suction dredging. It basically involves motorized rigs, which act like giant vacuum cleaners, sucking up mud and gravel from the bottom of a water course, and then using gravity to sort tiny quantities of gold from the rocks and dirt. But environmentalists say the technique disturbs riverbeds where fish such as Pacific salmon lay their eggs.
No, that wouldn't disturb salmon eggs, would it?
Yeah, no, they may very well have a case without knowing the details. Yeah. You know, some of the solutions could be, you know, they could buy the land. Maybe they haven't done that at this point, but...
No, they just get the permits, and they're right. Very inexpensive.
But, yeah, they know that puts kind of a deep six on my summer plans.
Yeah,
right. You plan to do a little panning this summer
vacation? Summer vacation, yep. Go find the gold in our hills.
You're going to have to sell that vacuum cleaner. That's all they do.
The shop vac.
But you can imagine, here we are now, we're right on the doorstep of something that those of us in the Liberty Movement have known was going to be coming for quite some time. We're right on the doorstep now of what is likely to be a very serious inflation at a time when people are going to be wanting to buy gold and silver and other precious metals. And here we have California trying to shut the door on any more gold exploration. Is that like the ultimate irony or what?
Yeah, there you go. I wonder if California, what percentage California provides at this point. You know, I think
it's pretty minor. I mean,
yeah, I would think so.
Certainly nowhere near where it was 162 years ago.
We ran into that in Oregon also, actually right around Portland, and they had a documentary on it, and the actual process was... They showed it, you know, because it was the same thing. They were contesting it, and the guy had the permit, and, you know, he says, I'm losing money. But the actual process was, I mean, it really, like, the river was not the river while the guy was working there, you know?
Right.
It was something. So.
Yeah. In fact, I can't remember if it was last week or the week before, but I shared that article with you guys about the prospector, I guess you call him, up in Canada, who had a rather formidable claim that could actually have a major gold reserve under it, and the story of how he tried to, over the years, stake out more and more of this territory because nobody really believed that there was this gold there, because that's what you do. You stake off your territory, and then you become the owner of the claim. Just a fascinating story. I don't expect anything like that's going to happen in California, even without this kind of issue, but it's kind of sad that... You know, it's kind of eliminating the possibility.
Yeah, I think they have gotten a lot of the gold in California.
Yeah, they've gotten a large portion of it, no doubt about that. No doubt whatsoever. Along the same theme of metals, we've been talking and making reference a few times to the fact that many of the leaders in the precious metals market have been talking about how there's going to be a lot of what's called volatility this summer. One of them is James Turk, who is the founder of Gold Money out of Germany. And King World News this past week asked him if he thought that we'd seen the lows in the metals. His reply was, well, you can never predict how long a correction is going to last or how deep it is going to go, but sometimes you get clues as to when a correction might be ending. What we've had is a bullish divergence in gold and silver, meaning that gold has been going up while silver hasn't been going up, which is kind of the reverse of what we were experiencing before. He said, so we have a pretty good level of certainty that the low prices in this correction are in place. And he continued by saying we may have a little bit more time to go in terms of backing and feeling, he says. And I don't rule out another test of $35 on silver and maybe back into the 15-20s on gold. But on the other hand, gold looks very, very powerful here. It hardly corrected at all compared to silver, which is why the ratio has gone back up over 40. So he says, I'm sticking to what I said last time we spoke, and he's on their program very often, that this summer is going to be a surprise for a lot of people on how powerful the metals are going to be on the upside. So there, once again, what we were referring to earlier, the fact that precious metal people are saying, you know, don't take your summer vacation just yet. This is going to be a summer to watch, Jake.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it'll be very interesting. And I think last week we covered the number of countries that we bombed under the current administration. I believe it was five. And I think that what I want to mention, too, is that the number needs to be moved up to six, because since President Obama took office, obviously we bombed Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, and then Libya. It's now become quite apparent in a New York Times article that we are continuing our bombing of Yemen, which took place under President Bush as well. And it's reported by the New York Times that the Obama administration has intensified the American covert war in Yemen, displaying a growing power vacuum in the country to strike at military suspects with armed drones and fighter jets, according to American officials. Again, the leader of Yemen, the dictator that was in charge for 33 years, who was... kind of on and off again, an American friend who was many times referred to by American presidents as a friend in the war against al-Qaeda and terror. He had left the country and fled to Saudi Arabia with burns over 40% of his body from a strike, assumedly from the opposition forces. What's very interesting is that, on Friday, American jets killed Abu Ali al-Harithi, which they claimed was a mid-level al-Qaeda operative, and several other militant suspects in a strike in southern Yemen. According to witnesses, four civilians were also killed in the airstrike. Weeks earlier, drone aircraft fired missiles aimed at Anwar al-Awlaki, which was the American cleric who was charged. He's an American citizen as well. That the American, the U.S. government has been trying to kill for more than a year. Mr. al-Awlaki was rumored to have survived.
Wow.
So it's pretty interesting that you don't hear any about this. I mean, this is the New York Times. It's the first time I've seen it there. But the fact that we now have, I guess, if you count Afghanistan and Pakistan as one war, the Iraq occupation, we're bombing Libya, which is rumored, also came out today, that the Libyan campaign is estimated to be costing U.S. taxpayers $2 million a day. It's probably going to go over the $750 million Pentagon estimate, and it's probably going to be well over $1 billion, which so for some might be small change, but that's still quite a bit, because all we have really is air missions and bombs dropping there. So
absolutely, yeah. And it was actually, we were talking about Sarah Palin before, and I realized just now I lost a perfect segue opportunity, but what you're talking about, Jake, also ties into oil, and that also ties into what I'm going to refer to. Gino, I was supposed to give this to you earlier, and I forgot to, so tell us what you have about the connection between Sarah Palin and what's going on in the Gulf, and you're going to have to do it in about a minute and a half because we don't have a lot of time left.
Okay, I'll just go over it real quick, but she had a quote on the impacts of the Gulf oil moratorium, and basically they're not opening any new drilling in the Gulf. And she mentioned it was we're 150,000 barrels a day we're going to lose, and she said it was 8 billion a day, and that's just they kind of checked with her people, and they didn't get back. She stood by that figure, and the figure was so far off. According to the latest projections by the EIA, that's a government agency that keeps track of the statistics, they're going at $104 to $108 per barrel. Anyway, it comes out to 13.6 million a day, and then for the next year, 34.6 million a day. So Palin's number of 8 billion was way, way off, and it just shows what we were talking about. She's a bit out of touch. You got to kind of get those numbers right if you want to be president, or get them close.
At the very least, you have to have a good research staff to give you the right numbers.
Exactly, exactly.
I mean, that makes me wonder who's doing her research for her, or is that something that she read out of the Reader's Digest?
Oh, it's probably a family business thing. Yeah, the Reader's Digest, there you go.
her daughter's heading up research between being pregnant. Good grief. Oh, dear. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to put up with more sale as the months come on. And, I guess maybe we'll just treat it as something fun and amusing. Is that the best way to handle it? I'm not really sure. One other thing I wanted to touch on before the program ends, and this isn't really new because it's not going to surprise anybody listening to this show or anybody who's broadcasting on this show, but Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank President Charles Plosser actually warned of inflation pressures. But he said, don't worry about it. Actually, the economy is going to be going just fine, and unemployment is going to be falling, so things are going to continue to improve.
Whatever he says.
But that was so weird. He actually said that we're going to have to pay a little bit closer attention to inflation. This guy is definitely a big-time monetarist, big-time supporter of what Bernanke's been doing. So I don't know. Maybe, Gene, maybe this is like the very, very first little salvo from the Fed saying, okay, maybe we're getting finally to the point where we're going to start easing up on this easy money policy we've been following.
Well, they have to admit that there's inflation first, I think.
They do have to. And unfortunately, we're not going to have an official word on that till July. I mean, because we do have the next CPI reading coming up in June, but that is for the May numbers. The June numbers don't show up until July. So July 15th or so, I don't know what the exact date is, but it's mid-July, is the very first time we're likely to see a jump in inflation that will have actually taken place in June. Because remember, the CEO of Walmart's already told us we're going to start seeing price increases in June.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see what they come up with.
Well, it's not only going to be interesting to see what they come up with, it's going to be interesting to see what they do with the last, what is it, like a month and a half before they can't deny it anymore. How much longer can they play this out? And Jake, correct me if I'm wrong, they don't, after the meeting that's coming up next week, they don't have another Fed meeting until August, isn't that right?
Yeah, the June 22nd meeting, I believe, is the last scheduled FOMC meeting. However, like in years of economic crisis, they certainly can call emergency meetings, and they have done so in the month of July. And I think we talked about that before. We kind of expect that to happen this summer around, too.
If they call an emergency meeting, that would be admitting inflation, you know, if the numbers come out like that and they say we're going to have a meeting.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll be meeting, but they might not be telling the public about it. And they
might not
call it an emergency meeting.
That may be the determinant. If they're holding an emergency meeting and we find out about it, is that the clue that they're finally going to wake up and say, oh, okay, inflation is here? Well, we've reached the end of the hour, and Jake and Gene, it's been a pleasure as usual. Want to remind everybody once again, visit the website, www.freedomnewshour.com, and Jake and Gene, we'll see you guys next week.
Okay, see you next week.
Take care, guys.
Goodbye, everybody.